Under the leaden, oppressive sky, the flotilla of small boats steadily worked its way around the island. Ryan was sweating from the effort, but not as much as the trainer who just sat there on the stern, looking ugly and smelling like new-fallen chem rain. At the extreme eastern tip of the island, there was no beach. The sea lapped up against a vertical wall of rock, 400 feet of it, without so much as a finger hold. As they rounded the corner, another, much smaller island came into view. A flat, buff-colored plate of volcanic rock, topped at its southern end by a low cinder cone. Not a twig, not a blade of grass grew on it. Ryan looked up at the larger island, which loomed above the islet like a skyscraper. Its backside was even more sheer than the front. There was no path, no rope rail up its face, no dwellings along its narrow beach, just wag-sized boulders of fallen granite.
Run the boats onto the shore! Good. Now everyone get out!
Ryan and Jack jumped down and moved closer to Mildred, Christy, and JB. Everyone made for the beach. Without a word of explanation, all the boats were relaunched, stranding the recruits. The uniforms rowed the trainers away, stopping about 50 yards off the beach. Because they were in the big island's lee, the boats didn't drift after the oars were shipped. They just hung there, dead still on the flat gray sea. The uniform captain stood on the bow of his boat and cupped his hands.
There are weapons waiting for you over the rise! Help yourselves!
There was no headlong rush to do that. The ex-Mercies and Sekmen hung back, wary of what might be waiting unseen on the other side.
Screw it! Let's get us some blades, boys!
The companions and the islanders joined Aang and walked over the rise. Astride the lip of the shallow bowl, they looked down on a big pile of edged weapons that had been dumped there. Ryan recognized some of the bayonets, AK-47, L-1A1F, M-5A1. But there were much older ones, too, designed for turn-of-the-20th-century Mauser and Enfield bolt guns. They were like short swords, handguards and all. Most of the other stuff was flashy crap meant to hang on a wall. Nothing anybody should bet their lives on. A Kyber knife, the base of its wide blade chipped out at the Choya, sword canes with bent and hand-restraightened double-edged blades, absent their scabbards, nicked cheapy Tanto knives and buoys, 35-inch-long Calcutta reproduction 1860 cavalry sabers with 10-carat gold-plated handguards. There was even a tomahawk peace pipe with a triangular splitting point. Except for the collection of sledgehammers, hand axes, and splitting mauls, it looked like an import cutlery house's garbage bin on pickup day. The companions and islanders without edged weapons, or those who wanted bigger ones, started rooting through the pile. Aang and his crew went for the sabers. The weapons were bloody and sticky, their edges nicked by impacts on bone and rock. The islanders didn't seem to care. A yard of steel was a big selling point. They carried their swords back to the sea and carefully rinsed off the gore. JB made a beeline for the tomahawk.
Pretty good.
Christy and Mildred picked up the circa 1900 bayonets. Excellent choices because the blades were respectively 15 and a half and 17 inches long and made of high-quality tempered steel. Jack tested the 8-inch blade of the AK bayonet on the ball of his thumb. Satisfied with its edge, he tucked it away. The companion stared across the bowl at the cinder cone on the opposite side. Smack dab in the middle of it was a pair of steel doors.
So I guess there's no need to keep cover.
Not anymore. We're not going anywhere right now. And we're in no more danger than anybody else.
All right, then. What the hell's gotten into Doc?
Yeah, it's not like him to turn tail and run like that.
Back in Vegas, Jack spotted him with the two he ran away with.
They've been following us?
Yeah, figure to the Matrans.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, but we can't worry about him right now. We can only hope he knows what he's doing and trust that it's the right thing.
Well, whatever it is he's doing, I hope he gets us out of here.
So, in other news...
Well, the volcano we're next to is dead. That's the good news.
And the bad news is the only training we're going to get is in how to die.
Up there.
Huh?
On that big island. That's where Magus is watching. You can be sure of that.
Oh, that's not a good sign.
Louder! Make their fucking bones shake!
It's as loud as it can go, Magus. Perhaps if we rerouted power from
no,
the...
No, no. Yeah, it will have to do.
Even inside the bosom of the mountain, the rhythmic vibrations could be felt. A fine dust of rock filtered down on them, shaken loose from the skybox's chiseled granite roof. Magus stood with his back to Sylum, looking out the broad floor-to-ceiling window. The silhouette was all lopsided, with odd angles where struts and braces supported or replaced its limbs. The half-steel head was studded with electrical inputs and hose bibs, festooned with brightly colored wires and silicon tubing filled with pink fluid. Salem wondered if, had the bulletproof window not been there, he would have risked all to step forward and give Magus a push. About four strides and a shoulder strike, and the reign of terror would have been over, as would his nightmare of fear and loathing. But the short answer was, no way. His paralysis had nothing to do with panic or lack of resolve. It had everything to do with status. Without steel eyes, Salem was just another con man and itinerant poisoner, traipsing the hellscape with a hokey statue in the back of his ox cart. Like it or not, they were joined, though not at the hip, as equals. Salem was an addendum to the master, a footnote, a big-headed mole on what little remained of Magus's human backside. Moving to the extreme edge of the window, as far from Magus as he could get and still see out, Salem gazed down upon the training ground from a lofty height. Beyond the flat patch of sea, he surveyed the spotted beige dish of rock, the recruits milling on the shore, still ignorant of what was to come, the mini battlefield, its array of monsters hidden, waiting, ready to attack. He thrilled to a sense of godlike power. This was what it was all about. Thanks to Magus's patronage, his dark fantasies came to life. Fantasies of revenge against a cruel world, against a cruel people. It allowed him to recast himself as dead gorgeous, dead smart, dead creative. Magus had given him an army of cold hearts and turned him loose to work his worst. Deathlands was his canvas, his marble, his ream of blank paper. The sad truth was, Salem had only one painting in him, one sculpture, one bit of verse. And he painted that same picture, sculpted that same statue, wrote that same epic poem over and over again. Only in his narcissistic fantasy did the work mature, evolve, outdo itself. If Magus was aware of this, if he even cared, if it was part of his plan, there was no way of telling. Steel Eyes was inscrutable. Trying to read his mind was like trying to read the mind of a wag engine. His goals, his pleasures, were never quite what they seemed. At times he appeared to be running amok. At times he seemed completely calculating. With Magus, appearances were always deceptive. Salem couldn't make out the faces of the recruits. They were a bit too far away. With his enhanced artificial eyes, Magus didn't have that problem. He could count their missing teeth.
Oh, my goodness. What have we here?
What is it, Magus?
A very special guest. You have outdone yourself today, Salem.
Ah, thank you. In what way, Magus?
You don't know, do you?
No. What?
You have delivered Ryan Corder to me. Him and his companions.
Corder?
One Eye.
The Butcher of Willyville? He's among the recruits?
Oh, this is a most glorious day, Salem. There will be no escape for the Cyclops this time. I have him, and I will crush him.
He raised a steel hand to Salem's face. It was less a hand than a motorized vice. The metal fingers closed in a tight fist. That inhuman grip could turn rock to powder.
Open the gates. Let the games begin.
JB cleaned his spectacles on the tail of his shirt, slipped them back on, then screwed down his fedora until it was touching the tops of his ears. He picked up the tomahawk from the ground at his feet and slipped his hand through the wrist thong. It had a nice balance. The handle was made of very hard wood, hollowed out its entire length. A small bowl was machined into the axe head. A replica peace pipe, tribe of origin lost in the 3,500-degree nuke wind.
Pretty good.
Got any ideas as to what's behind those doors?
I don't know, but from the stains on the rock and the sheer amount of blood on the ground, something triple bad.
At least he stopped playing that blasted music.
Yeah, but not before it got stuck in my head. What's with the big old symphony music every time?
He just likes to score his slaughter fests with pre-dark stuff like that.
He must think it's such great fun to mix butchery with symphonic classics.
JB glanced at Ryan and the rest of the companions. They were all relaxed, their breathing even and slow, conserving their energy. Most of the other recruits had done just the opposite. They had yelled obscenities at the uniforms and trainers in the drifting boats and stomped around the shoreline waving their blades. Like Ryan, the islanders held their own council and let no emotion show. The way they gathered behind their scar-faced captain, sabers poised, gave JB the feeling they knew exactly what they were going to do and how they were going to do it.
Everybody just keep cool. React when we see what we're up against.
What if it's blasters?
Then we die.
Hope it's not blasted.
It won't be. Magus likes his entertainment to stretch on and on. He wants to see people suffer and die slowly.
Wazis.
Here they come. They were dark brown, long-necked, featherless creatures, their 7-foot-long wings flapping. Wazis. Full-grown Wazis. 5 of them. Half gator, half condor, Wazis usually dropped out of the night sky like precision-guided bombs upon the unsuspecting, the slow, and the sleepy. Though they preferred to hunt after sundown, when starved, they took their meat any time they could find it. They leapt into the air. Instinctively, the fighters closed ranks as the Wazis struggled to gain altitude. After climbing to about 15 feet above the ground, they began to circle around the islet.
Why aren't they getting any higher?
Their wings have been torn and clipped.
Normally, the creatures would have used their 17-foot wingspans to catch the thermals off the cliff face of the big island, riding them, spiraling up through the cloud bank and out the other side. Like condors, they were master gliders, capable of rising to impossible heights, then coasting on the wind currents for hundreds of miles. These were landlocked Wazis, and they were not happy about it. As they flew past, the wind they made buffeted JB's face. They shifted into an attack formation, with the biggest bird in front, then 3 abreast, and the smallest one bringing up the rear. Their reptilian heads pivoted on their long necks as they sized up their prey. Some of the recruits threw their knives at the things, which either missed their targets or hit sideways, or were deftly plucked out of the air by the Wazi's long beaks. Flying lower, circling closer, the lizard birds dipped and darted, wheeling, snapping, clawing at the unprotected heads without actually making contact, almost in a teasing, testing way. Under the pressure, many of the recruits withdrew from the perimeter, moving down into the depressed center of the bowl, edging closer to the cone and its open doors. A bad idea. The companions and the islanders maintained their distance from the cone, ducking under the reach of the slashing black tritalons as they swept overhead.
What's with this musical chair shit? Oh, hell no. Stickies!
A torrent of pale two-legged forms poured from the doorway. Stickies by the dozens rushed down the shallow slope, waving their skinny arms. It was at that moment the Wazis attacked, diving into the fringes of the crowd, their talons outstretched. Knives and even short swords were of little use against the lizard birds. They were too fast, too agile, and the reach of their necks and claws was too long. In their sweeping circuits of the islet, in the seemingly playful feints and mock slashes, they had picked out their victims, the easiest meals. Not 10 feet in front of JB, the lead Wazi had slammed into a sec man's back. The Wazi, talons dug into the man's shoulder blades, tried to carry him off. With its slashed wings, though, it couldn't rise any higher than a yard off the ground. A second bird joined the lead, sinking its claws into the man's chest. Together, the Wazis bore him up. The man kicked and punched, to no avail. As they climbed to 50, 60, 75 feet, they fought, snapping, dodging, flapping, pulling and twisting their prize in opposite directions. If they'd had some decent leverage to work with, somewhere solid to plant their feet, they might have torn him in two. But as it was, they both simply tore out their respective chunks of muscle. In the middle of the bowl, Norm and Sticky collided in a howling, screaming din. The muties drove an 8-abreast column into the middle of the mass of recruits, a wedge intended to split the Norm force. The recruits gave ground, yielding to the pressure, and then tried to flank and surround the headlong charge. The Sticky's rampage was unstoppable. While the muties along the wedge's front row did battle, the ones behind jumped over their backs and onto the stunned recruits. Once a Sticky grabbed hold of those sucker fingers and its adhesive secretions, it never let go. By the sheer weight of numbers, the muties pinned their foes to the ground. The battle turned into a melee. No field commander could have kept order. No battle plan could have survived that first head-on impact. The Sticky's frenzy was such that they felt no pain. They withstood wounds to their heads, arms, torsos, and kept on pressing forward, driving their wedge deeper. The Norms who were pulled down were dragged by their faces from the ranks of their own kind, dragged into the sticky fold, where the serious tearing began. Though stickies were generally of small stature and wiry build, they were hellishly strong. With their suckers and brute strength, they split open bellies. With their needle teeth, they ripped out hearts in chunks. Those that disappeared under the wave of pale bodies never rose again. The recruits answered frenzy with frenzy, stabbing, slashing, and clubbing. White limbs fell severed to the ground, sucker hands, arms, legs. Blood gushed and flowed, Muti and Norn, indistinguishable to the naked eye. It was the brand of warfare practiced in the Stone Age, before the invention of body armor or battle shields. Brute bludgeoning power against brute bludgeoning power. Foes trading blows, exchanging gaping wounds. Bloodied men stumbling over the gray loops of their own spilled intestines. Stickies hacked apart with dull swords, their bodies broken, pulped by sledgehammers.
That bastard tin can's up there laughing at us. Laughing.
Another Wazi had swooped, dead falling from a height of 20 feet, and struck. Only this time, the quarry was an islander. The lizard bird frantically flapped its long wings, dragging 250 pounds of violently resisting prey along the shoreline. Its black talons were buried in the flesh of the islander's tattooed shoulders, the points curving deep beneath his collarbones. The man's flesh puckered, stretching under his body weight. His bare feet scrabbled and slipped over the rocks.
JB!
On it!
The two of them sprinted toward the bird before it could gather enough speed to take off.
Damn things! Stronger than it looks!
Yeah! Damn tenacious! Thanks, Christy.
Anytime.
Thank you.
The islander started to stumble away, bleeding profusely from inch-wide holes in his chest and back. Whether it was the smell of the blood everywhere, or some message in the dying bird's scream, the other four Wazis swarmed in.
Watch out!
The maimed islander was their sole target. Talons raked his head and slashed the back of his neck. He fell to his stomach, and the biggest bird landed on his back, sinking its claws into his flesh. The islanders rushed forward to try to rescue their kin, but the Wazi immediately let go of their shipmate's buttocks and shifted position. The poor, wounded bastard was still alive when a Wazi took his head sideways in its mouth. Juices squirted from between its jaws. Then it started sawing with its serrated teeth. In an eye blink, the islander's headless body dropped free, blood gushing from the tattered neck stump. Gulping down its prize, the Wazi jumped into the air and flapped away.
You dirty fucking flying mutant! You piss-goggling, triple-stoop, man-eating fuck! I'll cut out your heart and spit in your fucking face!
Down in the bowl where Jack battled, the stickies were pushing the recruits in reverse, blades flashing, scuffling feet raising rock dust. Behind the blur of arms and heads, in the wake of the sticky advance, was a slick carpet of red. As the battle sawed back and forth, crumpled bodies, Norm and Muti were revealed, then hidden again. Suddenly, Jack saw Wazi grip Christy from behind by the shoulders of her fur coat. Because she didn't weigh more than 150 pounds, the flapping bird was able to drag her away. The toes of her boots skimmed a few inches above the ground. Christy couldn't bring her bayonet to bear. Her arms were trapped in the sleeves of her coat by the downward pull of her own body.
Christy!
Ryan was already too far away, but he was dashing at speed. Jack was even farther away, but he had something Ryan didn't. The albino wheeled, shaking a leaf-bladed knife from his sleeve. The blade found its natural place in his hand, like a steel ball rolling into a precision-drilled hole. There was no hesitation, no thought, no aiming. The creature's left eye practically disappeared. Jolted by the impact, the bird dropped Christy.
Christy, are you okay?
Yeah, just a little rattled. Jack saved me.
It's coming down! Everybody out of the way!
Captain Aang came running toward the bird. He drove his blade into its torso with every ounce of his 300 pounds behind it. The Wazi reared up, its wings stiffly outspread, as 35 inches of cold steel slid into its guts. The bird tried to claw its tormentor, and found it couldn't reach him. Aang held it fast to the ground with his strength and the skewering blade. Unable to use its talons, the Wazi tried to tear his head off with its beak.
Oh, I knew I'd have you. Just didn't think I'd have you so soon. This is for my crewmate, fucker!
Aang grabbed the saber, and with both hands in the sword's grip, twisted the curving blade. The tendons in his massively scarred forearms jumped as he cored out a deeper, far more devastating wound. Gore and intestinal content spewed over Aang's arms and bare chest. With the last of its strength, the Night Hunter drew in its leathery wings, a look of surprise in its surviving eye. That it would meet its end at the hands of a hairy, grinning, earthbound creature had to have come as a shock. Watching Aang work reaffirmed Jack's belief that there was much to like about the Islander captain. Rish hung well back from the cone's doorway in a small protected alcove.
That's item number 2 off your checklist, Xylem. Stickies.
Even in Deathlands, at the bottom of human culture's ash bin, behind every successful and competent twit, there was a creature such as Rish, a diligent, hardworking, unrecognized soul. Rish was no longer stunned when Xylem took credit for his ideas. "I know you won't mind if I use that," was a phrase he had come to loathe. Of course, it wouldn't have mattered if he had minded. All homage went to Xylem. While Rish was sucking up, salaaming to the poet laureate, what was he really thinking? Blockhead? Drooler? Pompous ass? If he had to listen to that Hammurabi story about how Xylem had chiseled a dirt farmer into giving him a free ride on all his daughters one more time, he thought he was going to go berserk. There was another side, a hidden side to Rish. He had dreams of his own. He knew he could do Xylem's job because he'd been doing it for months, virtually by himself. Magus's head liar was a burnout case, and Rish knew he could do the job a million times better than Xylem ever had. Rish realized that some of his feelings of rage and bitterness were fueled by natural jealousy over his own physical shortcomings. Xylem was tall. He had normal-sized hands and feet. Although he had a very strange-looking forehead, Xylem wasn't cursed with a face that radiated perpetual misery. Even when Rish was deliriously happy, he looked like his dog had just died. What infuriated him most was that he was often mistaken for a western swampy, an ankle biter. Even though he was not filthy, bearded, or hairy, the resemblance in stature had made him scrupulous about his hygiene. He scraped his jowls twice a day and buffed his little hands until they were pink. If his arms had had more than a fine pale down on them, he would have shaved them too. Rish would never be any taller, never have manly hands and feet, never be looked upon by women with anything but revulsion, but he could orchestrate mayhem with the best of them. After the Wazi's cages had been rolled back, he had sent out the cage of stickies, pushed and prodded by the enforcers. Rish didn't even know if the enforcers could talk. If they could, they certainly never did it in the presence of a norm. Rish could list what he knew about the enforcers on the fingers of one tiny hand. They hated fire, they could see perfectly in the dark, they sweated in their sleep, and they slept in big piles, like cats. Big, sweaty piles. They never seemed to eat or drink. If their race had a culture, it was locked away in their heads. They had no tools, no books, no written language, no clothes, yet they understood and obeyed those in Magus's chain of command. It filled Rish with a dizzying sense of power to be able to order around such terrible destructive forces, but he was no fool. He knew the limits of that power and the extent of his own vulnerability. It had occurred to him before that all he had to do to get Xylem's job was to keep quiet, to just agree with whatever idiotic plan the Spin Doctor set out, to refrain from offering subtle suggestions and advice, to stop posing key questions that revealed fundamental grievous errors, to stop personally altering programs after the fact, to correct the headliar's bonehead mistakes. In his little hairless hand, he held the sword of Xylem's destruction. Along the side of the cheap ballpoint pen in his grip, emblazoned in gold paint, were the words Sunset West Motel, Bloomfield, NM. There was nothing wrong with the scheduled order of attack, but as usual, Xylem hadn't bothered to read the careful win-loss odds projections that Rish had done. If the Spin Doctor had even glanced at them, he would have seen his battle plan was badly flawed, including the Islanders in this afternoon's festivities had been Rish's bright idea, not Xylem's. Although Xylem had quickly adopted the clever twist as his own, he hadn't thought through some of the obvious consequences. That core of seasoned organized fighters needed to be dealt with first, singled out, targeted, and destroyed. Instead, they were ignored, treated as run-of-the-mill mercies. Xylem had signed off on the choreography. It was his baby. There was no way for him to pass the blame. Rish had a choice, to save Xylem or let him flame. He chose flame. Rish had never actually seen Magus angry. Seeing him pleased was scary enough.
Hey! We're starving! Come on, feed us! This is torture!
Yeah! Feed us, you stumpy little bastard! We're wasting away!
Between massive, drooping dugs, the scalies' wrinkled bellies sagged a good 2 feet over the waistbands of their flowing, raggedy skirts. Even though these two were relative lightweights for the species, they still weighed close to 400 pounds. Their monumental appetites were what made them a regular feature of Magus' little military melodramas.
Oh, shut up, both of you! You're up next on the program. You'll get all you can eat in a few minutes.
The scalies' expressions immediately brightened.
It's difficult to breathe through all this mist.
We gotta keep moving. On the double!
Doc, Bell, and Kirby trudged blindly upward. It got even darker as they climbed. 4 feet of visibility dropped to 3, then 2. If the rope rail hadn't been there, they would have most certainly blundered off the cliff to their deaths.
Oh, the mist is getting thicker. Antoine, you're sure we haven't passed it already?
We couldn't have. This trail's a dead end, like I said. It's the redoubt's emergency exit route, and the only way out of the place from the north side. The main entrance and exit is on the far side of the mountain.
You've been here before, then?
Yeah, but the secret installation hadn't been built when I visited.
Then how do you know so much about it?
I used the databanks in our redoubt to access the site's physical layout. Pulled a hard copy of the setup. Super detailed, floor by floor, room by room.
Doc stopped listening. He was as lost in self-doubt as he was in the swirling, choking grayness. Questions that he couldn't answer kept popping into his head, over and over. To have thrown his lot in with these two strangers, all or nothing, was a measure of the depth of Doc Tanner's desperation and spiritual exhaustion. He wanted to believe that what they were offering him was real. He wanted it with all his soul.
I think there's something ahead.
Yeah? What is it?
It's metal. Feels like a door. Yeah! There's a key padlock beside the frame!
Kirby carefully stepped around Doc to get closer. The swirling cloud that surrounded them was sucked away, drawn into the redoubt by a humidity or temperature gradient. Doc stared at the open doorway that had gobbled up the fog like a hungry mouth. The banks of fluorescent lights flickered weakly, casting an amber glow on a long corridor.
Listen!
The rope snapped hard against Doc's grip. After a momentary pause, it jerked again.
By the three Kennedys, one of those beasts is still following us.
Come on, Tanner.
Kirby grabbed hold of Doc's shoulder and pulled him into the redoubt.
This should keep him out.
Unless it knows how to use the lock, maybe we better shake a leg.
This redoubt was similar to all the others Doc had seen. It was furnished in a grim institutional style. Gray tiled floors and walls, broad rooms with low acoustic ceilings, rooms that were divided into a maze of cubbyhole offices by chin-high, movable partitions. Unlike most of the other redoubts, this one hadn't been looted and ransacked. The deserted workstations and tables were neat under their thick coating of dust. There were no papers strewed over the floor. The computer screens were unsmashed. There was evidence of heavy foot traffic, though. Big footprints tracked through the dust along the main hallway, and there were dark, muddy places where falling drips of sweat had mingled with the unswept dirt of more than a century.
What is that smell?
Acetone. Trainers have been here.
There's been no audible alarm. Think they're looking for us already?
Count on it.
We gotta go down again. The Mattrans gateway is 8 floors below us.
Then we better use an elevator. No way can we control the stairwells against the trainers.
Where are we going, if I may ask?
We're about to jump from here to our redoubt. That's where the Kronos machinery is. We go... this way.
As they walked through the corridor, Doc wondered if anyone had ever worked here. There were no personal items at any of the workstations. Just blank gray corkboards, bookshelves with neatly stacked, spiral-bound technical manuals, a forest of identical ergonomic chairs. It appeared that all this effort, all this expense, had been for nothing.
And here's the elevator, right where it should be.
Best luck we've had in a while.
Keep your blasters trained on the door. Empty. And everybody in.
Ugh. I do think those creatures have been in this very elevator.
Tell me about it. Smells like a paint factory.
This is some high-octane sweat. Do you think it's safe to use the elevator? Something in the motor could spark off on us and wham, we got ignition.
If it didn't fireball when I hit the up button, it probably won't now. Oh, shit, that traitor got in.
It would appear the risk of descent has been superseded by the risk of staying here.
You heard him, Kirby. Push the down button.
I did push it. It's not working.
Did you push it right?
You can't push a button wrong, Graydon.
Shit, here he comes. Get him!
Tiles from the ceiling fell from the ricochets. Shattered computer monitors and exploded light shot glass through the corridor. Doc braced himself against the doorframe and carefully aimed for the trainer's eyes. The creature held its taloned hand in front of its face and advanced at a dead run. Bullets and pistol balls smacked into it. It soaked them up like a sponge and kept on coming. Though it spurted some blood, it seemed to have no vitals to hit.
Close, you fucking elevator! Close!
Shit, shit, shit!
What is this music?
Get ready.
They braced themselves and took aim at the doors. As Doc had no time to reload the Lama, he drew his sword. He was unsure what, if anything, that weapon could do against the trainers, but it made him feel better to have a blade in his hand, ready to strike. In front of them was a deserted hallway. A profusion of muddy tracks ran down its center.
Hold up. I'm just gonna keep this elevator occupied. There. I don't know if those things can operate elevators, but sending the car to every floor will give us a bit more time. Let's go.
As they advanced, Bell and Kirby checked the rooms on either side of the hall to make sure they were clear.
Oh, man.
What?
Have a look at this. Just come look. It's a mess.
There weren't any sweaty footprints in the long room. It was a different sort of mess. The concrete floor was stained with blood and caustic chemicals, littered with boxes full of parts, medical, automotive, computer. Along one wall was a virtual machine shop with lathes, computerized drill presses, punch and milling machines. Low shelves were stacked with bar stock. On the opposite wall was a walk-in refrigerator and dozens of translucent 55-gallon plastic drums containing shadowy, fetal position human forms. The barrels were topped off with formaldehyde, which acted as a room freshener. In the center of the space, under powerful spotlights, was either an operating table or a mortuary slab. It was occupied.
What the hell is this?
Oh, it's Magus's private laboratory. He fancies himself something of a virtuoso.
Come again?
He's a dabbler in things scientific, or pseudo-scientific, a talented amateur.
The thing on the operating table might have debated that last point. It lay on its back, wrists and ankles belted in place. It had been flayed, opened up, layer by layer. Each layer was pinned back with stainless steel surgical clamps. Its chest cavity had been split wide, and its organs open to the air and the hard light. Much of what he or she had been born with was missing. The eyes, the top of the skull, the genitalia. Muscle had been removed from both calves. Inside the red chasm of torso, a heart still beat laboriously. Glistening lungs heaved.
Oh, God, it's alive.
Do you think it's conscious? Do you think it knows?
If so, it will thank me for this.
Doc thrust his sword point through the middle of the pounding heart and out the other side.
One less toy for the monster to amuse himself with. Rest in peace, poor soul.
They left Magus's playroom and continued on to the end of the hall. It turned out that Kirby's map was accurate. Before them was the entrance to the redoubt's Metrans unit. The control room was unoccupied, but its bank of computer drives were active, and every monitor screen was lit. Doc immediately picked out the massive metal door set in the far wall. It had an inches thick, circular, gasketed window.
Is it working?
Let's see. Yes. Yes. System status is green across the board. Destination GUI fully functional.
Kirby walked to the chamber's door. It opened, revealing a small, low-ceilinged gateway. The armor-glass panels on the walls were marbled red and black and shot through with seams of gold.
All right! The system is good to go. The coordinates are input.
The trainer caught Colonel Bell from behind, pulling him away from the computer bank. Before he could reach the pistol grip of his M16, an amber talon flicked out and stabbed into his ear.
Bell!
As Doc backed toward the Matrans unit doorway and the black man swung up his assault rifle, the trainer used its other amber gut hook to draw a line of red across the front of Bell's throat. As the dying man crashed into the rows of monitors, the mutie lunged for the Matrans gateway and more victims. Kirby shoved the muzzle of his M16 at the onrushing mutie's chest. Orange flames spewed from the muzzle onto the trainer's sweat-slicked skin. The explosion lifted Doc off his feet and sent him flying backward through the chamber door. The sword stick and its ebony sheath clipped the edges of the doorway and flipped out of his hands across the control room. As his backside hit the plates, all 250 pounds of Dr. Kirby landed sprawled across his legs. His ears ringing, Doc rolled out from under the scorched mathematician. The jump mechanism didn't automatically start when the door closed. Doc could see the trainer through the thick window glass. It spun around and around, the fire that billowed from its torso sheeting up over its face and head, black oily smoke staining the ceiling. Like a drunkard, the flaming mutie stumbled out into the hall, leaving the control room full of smoke.
That thing is not of this earth.
Doc was stunned that the realization hadn't come to him before this, but Bell and Kirby, also trained observers, hadn't seen it either. Sometimes the obvious was the most elusive. No creature born of this planet could evolve with the trainer's limitation, their fatal flaw. Copious, flammable perspiration was non-adaptive, which meant the trainers had to come from elsewhere, or as a doomy hag once described it, elsewhen, a place where the physical laws of Earth did not apply, a place where the combustion of volatile materials occurred at a much higher temperature.
Good God! Graydon's gone! After all this and he's gone!
More trainers appeared in the control room doorway. They peered in, leery of the smoke.
You didn't know him! You didn't know his incredible brilliance! Graydon Bell was one of the greatest minds in the history of humankind! He was a second Einstein! And on top of that, a truly valiant, a courageous man! He gave up everything to turn back the clock.
We must leave now, Dr. Kirby.
I know. This mission must succeed. There.
The metallic floor plates beneath Doc's boots began to glow softly, growing brighter and brighter as the power level climbed. Doc smelled ozone, and when he looked up at the ceiling, he saw the tendrils of jump mist beginning to form, drifting down around them. The armor glass walls started pulsating as if alive. The seams between the floor plates at Doc's feet appeared to part, to spread wider and wider. And then he was falling through the yawning gap, falling into blackness at terrific speed. By choosing to stay back on the rim and battle the Wazis, Ryan had given the Stickies time to fully commit themselves. But that had to change, and now.
Everybody behind me!
All right.
What's going on?
We're going on the offensive.
Oh-ho! I'll gladly play along. Io! Trubo! Trubo!
As the companions and the Islanders joined, the plan soon became clear. The idea was simple and straightforward. Pure Roman legion. Meet the point of the sticky wedge with as much power as they could muster. Break the wedge apart so the recruits already in the bowl could encircle and kill the fragmented groups of stickies. First, however, they had to push through the ranks of their own kind. They jumped over the bodies of the fallen, of the wounded trying desperately to pull themselves away. These were nothing like the casualties of Great Caesar's army. This was an altogether different sort of hand-to-hand meat grinder. The wounds were not clean-edged cuts and punctures from blades and spears. They were ragged holes, divots where skin and muscle had been ripped or bitten away. Christy ran on Ryan's right, close on his heels. Around his broad shoulder, she could see waving pale arms and swinging blades, and a red mist rising up from the hellish field of combat. Mildred sprinted on her left. JB and Jack were right behind them. The Islanders brought up the rear, swinging their sabers like rotary blades. The last recruits in their way saw what was coming and gave ground. Ryan was the point of attack, the tip of the Norm wedge. His panga flashing, he hurled himself into the enemy line. Christy was right behind him. Ryan's fists and feet and blade sent bodies flying to either side. To keep her bayonet from getting stuck in bone, Christy slashed and hacked with it, using the double-edged point and razor-sharp edge rather than the full length of the blade. To get the most power while continuing to move forward, she swung overhead. The bayonet point drew lines of red down the middle of the pale faces, dividing them from forehead to chin. Clutching the split seams together, blood gushing between their sucker fingers, the wounded stickies twisted away and dropped to their knees. The islanders came in right behind, slashing the fallen with their sabers, widening the column's breach. The term bloodbath was invented to describe a scene like this. From the tips of flashing swords and bayonets, from the heads of falling hammers and axes, sprays of gore flew in all directions, falling like hot, copper-scented rain. The ground underfoot was crimson and slick, like it had been lubricated with axle grease. The muties that melted to either side of the wedge point found themselves caught under islander steel or trampled by islander feet. It wasn't in the stickies' nature to ever take a step back. They lacked the hardwiring for retreat, or they couldn't think that far ahead. Once they got their chill lust up, they pressed on to victory or death. Non-fatal wounds didn't stop or even slow them. Missing arms, hands, parts of their heads, they threw themselves forward. Christy dodged a wounded mutie's wild lunge. She pivoted and braced her back leg, and as she let it slip past, thrust 15.5 inches of steel into its exposed side. As she turned back to meet another adversary, out of the corner of her eye, she saw the sticky she'd just stabbed popping up from the ground like it was on springs, just in time for the top of its bald head to meet JB's tomahawk downswing. The skull shattered like a dinner plate under JB's vicious tomahawk strike. Ryan's strategy worked like a charm. The shattered column of stickies found itself caught between gauntlets of norms. The recruits attacked them from one side, and the companions and islanders from the other. Three deep, the trapped muties were battered front and rear by blades and 10-pound hammers. Christy could see the blood-spattered faces of the recruits on the other side of the stickies' wildly jerking bodies. The eyes of the ex-mercies and sectmen were full of triumph. At last, they were getting the upper hand.
Batu! Batu! Wakangaro! Batu! Batu! Wakangaro!
Under the circumstances, Ryan didn't need a translator to get the drift. The 300-pound tattooed island warriors were bellowing, "Kill 'em all! Kill 'em all!" The islanders' swings were so powerful, they could have beheaded their foes with 3-foot lengths of unmilled bar stock. As Ryan plowed into the muties' midst, he saw that some of them were otherwise engaged. The stickies farther back in the column, separated from the hand-to-hand by their brethren, were kneeling or squatting, taking the opportunity to feed on the fallen recruits. They raised gory mouths from the whips on carcasses as Ryan bore down on them. They looked up at him with dead black eyes, still chewing. Ryan would have had to lean down to strike them with a panga, which would have cost him time. Instead, he kicked them in the head with his heavy boots. The impacts sent shockwaves to his hip sockets. His boot prints branded their vacant faces. Because the feeding stickies farther along could see him coming, they were forewarned. Ryan rammed headlong into multiple attackers. He fired up a straight kick into a sticky's chest, knocking it sprawling. Then he backhanded the panga, side-slashing across an undefended throat, opening a yawning second mouth under its pale chin. The forehand stroke that followed hacked into the side of the next mutie's neck. As the sticky spun away, its arterial blood spurted in a fine spray. As Ryan saw it, there was only one hope for the companion's survival. After fracturing the enemy point and dividing its column, they had to continue to drive their own spear through the sticky ranks, all the way to the cone's double doors. If they could reach that gate and control it, they could stop the flow of mutie reinforcements and control the field of battle. If they failed to reach those steel doors, he had little doubt that they were all going to die. With that in mind, Ryan cut a 6-foot-wide swath through the mutie forces. After hammering the skull of a sticky with a pommel of his panga, he hurled the unconscious body onto those coming up behind. Before they could get out from under the tangle of limbs, he was on them. As he stomped their pale necks, he caught a blur movement around the edge of the bowl. Above the sea of bobbing heads and waving arms, stickies were sprinting to the rear, trying to outflank the norms. Ryan had to watch as the stickies pounced on the shoulders of the recruits, sucker fingers grabbing for the eyes, dragging them backward onto the ground, then ripping off their skin and muscles. All the freshly spilled blood and the promise of more to come was making the muties go even wilder. JB jogged across the dish in the 3-spot behind Ryan and Mildred, on the left. The stickies, who moved out of the one-eyed point man's reach, who survived the slash of Mildred's bayonet, were his responsibility. Undeterred by their narrow escape from death, or perhaps energized by it, the muties lunged back into the fray with a vengeance, hands groping for the armorer's face. He tomahawked him as he ran by, swinging only at the heads he knew he could hit squarely. His sizzling backhanded axe blows sent the muties crashing face first onto the rock. JB knew where Ryan was heading, and he recognized the importance of speed in getting there. Like his old friend, the armorer had acquired a handle on Magus's modus operandi the hard way. From experience, he knew that what they were facing now was just prelude. There would be new beasts to fight soon enough. Short of a complete turnabout, the wearing down of the Gnome forces was inevitable, as was their defeat. He knew there would eventually come a point when he wouldn't be able to lift the tomahawk, let alone swing it with killing force, unless they could shut those double-cone doors permanently. Then JB saw what Ryan had seen moments ago. Rapid movement at the fringes of the battle that was counter to the flow. The flanking maneuver was perfectly timed and executed. The recruits facing JB were pulled down by dozens of pale hands. In the blur of flying bodies, he saw men pinned to the ground and bitten. Bald heads savagely shaking, needle teeth tearing out chunks. Under the weight of the counterattack, the recruit gauntlet collapsed. In arm-waving droves, stickies broke through the holes they'd torn in the ranks. JB was forced to back up or be overrun. Cutting the tomahawk left and right, he kept the muties at bay. The armorer sensed the companions were pulling in behind him, battlemates drawing together shoulder to shoulder for mutual defense. It was the last stand formation. Out of the corners of his eyes, JB saw Jack's flying white hair on his right and Mildred's strong brown arms on his left. Their blades flashed in the weak daylight. Blood varnished the steel. Overhead, the Wazis dipped and dived, buffeting them with wing wash and snatching at their heads with black tri-talons. The lizard birds knew the game was just about up. JB could see the Islanders move into a back-to-back fighting formation a short distance away. The huge men circled right to left. They were a human-powered cutting machine. Anything that came within 35 inches fell to pieces and died. Christie and the other companions moved into a back-to-back position as well. It was standard protocol, the only way to survive under the circumstances. Jack bumped backs with Mildred. The good doctor looked like holy hell. The beads of sticky blood on her face, arms, and plaited hair had mixed with sweat and dripped down the front of her OD t-shirt. Her BDU pants were likewise striped and spattered with gore. Her eyes were wide. A Wazi dive-bombed the Islander circle, catching one of the sailors across the forehead with a claw. As blood gushed out, the lizard bird smelled it and immediately reversed course for another pass. As it flapped and turned, it hung stationary for a split second, and that was all the time Jack needed. In a move too fast to follow, he shook another throwing blade out of his sleeve and launched it at a slight up angle. The knife had slammed the Wazi in the side of the head, right behind its ear hole. It wasn't a killing strike, but it brought the bird down hard. It had managed to clear the waving Islander swords, but crash landed on the stickies who were attacking them. Its legs churned, talons clawing as it tried to jump back into the air. The stickies tore it to ribbons. Unable to fly off, the Wazi took out its insane fury on everything in range of its jaws. When there were no more stickies within reach, it turned upon itself. After the grounded Wazi twisted its long neck into a U, it tore through the leathery skin on its chest in a couple of snaps and kept right on biting, through layers of muscle, through bone. It bit until its head was buried past the eyes in its own chest. That's how it died, looking inward. In order to restrain himself from delivering a running commentary on the battle, Sylum dug his fingernails into the palms of his hands and bit the tip of his tongue. Although the urge to point things out and to jump up and down while doing it was powerful, he knew better than to intrude on Magus's enjoyment. But now Sylum's heart began to pound as he took in the scope of an unfolding problem. Two of the Wazis, almost half of his air power, his command of the sky, had been hauled down in short order and promptly slaughtered on the edges of the fray. The sticky column was well on its way to dividing the recruit force until the wedge of Gnomes crashed into them, spear point against spear point, with that one-eyed bastard Carter leading the charge. Sylum watched in disbelief as the sticky formation melted into disarray. The Islanders had banded together. They were working as a single cohesive unit, killing everything that got within 36 inches of their phalanx. Sylum's heart skipped a beat. Steel Eyes had never shown impatience with a performance so early on. It was natural in a life-and-death military drama for control of one side or the other to wax and wane, for a seemingly inevitable defeat or victory to suddenly reverse itself. Magus's enjoyment depended in large part upon giving the intended victims the illusion that they had a chance, right up to the big finale when all hope was crushed. So why was Magus concerned already? The answer was simple. Ryan Carter. The one-eyed man wasn't just in charge of his own crew, he was leading the Islanders into battle, and in the process, wreaking devastation upon the Stickies. From his high vantage point, Salem guessed about 40 or 50 had been killed. Losses on the Norm side amounted to only half that. Sylum tried to remain calm, He reminded himself that the Stickies and Wazzy's only purpose was to reduce the recruits' numbers and break them into small, vulnerable groups. That done, the less mobile Scalies and Swampies would be released to take advantage of the surrounded and stationary norms. They would be followed by the smaller creatures that were extremely fast and extremely hard to kill, with the Screamies doing the final mop-up. But long before the first act had reached its scheduled climax, Magus did something he had never done before. He called down the curtain.
Send in the clowns!